Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the CU Denver Events Board, I'd like to proudly introduce to you Dr. Michael Prenny, who will speak on images of imperialism, media myths, and reality. Thank you.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here, and my thanks to Matthew Chilson and his associates for all the hard organizing work they did to make this occasion necessary, as Yogi Berra would say. I'm going to talk about, if I can get the microphone sort of away so that I could look at find my notes here. There's always an adjustment problem. Don't touch this one. This is yours? We're all slaves of technology here, aren't we? I'm going to talk about a subject which is never talked about, really, very rarely. And yet it's the most important subject in the world. That is, it's the most important force in the world today. And it has been the most important force in shaping the map of the world for the last 400 years. And yet people don't talk about it in the U.S. The media doesn't talk about it. Political scientists don't talk about it. Social scientists don't. Publishers wouldn't talk about it. I'm talking about imperialism. And if you say U.S. imperialism, they really wouldn't talk about it at all and would think you're kind of odd or that you're being ideological. Imperialism is simply not a word that's used. There are other words like development theory, dependency theory, and all sorts of euphemisms. Although there's a perfectly good word that was used for hundreds of years. It was called imperialism. It was even used by Jefferson in Washington. They talked about the American Empire and such, talked about it proudly. If you put the adjective Soviet imperialism in front of it, then they might listen and say, oh yes, problem. Less so than it used to be, but it's a problem. If you put the adjective British imperialism and say 19th century, then they might acknowledge, yeah, there was a colonial period. But imperialism is really a force that is going on, and at an accelerated rate, it continues today. Imperialism is when the ruling interests of one country expropriate the land, the labor, the resources, and the capital of another country. That's what it means. That's what it's always meant. It may do it by direct conquest, or may do it by more indirect forms. Today, what we have is what we call neo-imperialism or neo-colonialism, wherein you don't own the country, but you simply control its land, labor, and resources indirectly. The first practitioners of neo-imperialism was the United States in Cuba, where we went in there in 1904, and we said, we went in earlier than that, but in 1904 we said, look, we stole you fair and square from the Spaniards, and but it doesn't look so good, a republic having a big empire like this, so we're going to give you your independence, and you can now have your own flag, and that flag will be red, white, and blue, and it'll have one white star on it. You get only one star, not like us, because you're a small country. And you could have your own currency, and your own president, and your own constitution, and all we have is we'll control your tobacco industry, and your sugar industry, and your rum industry, and your oil refineries, and your imports, and your exports, and your agribusiness, and your tourist trade. That's all. And just to make sure that these things are thoroughly protected, in case you get out of line, we have the Pratt Amendment in the Constitution, which says that we can come in with the Marines anytime we want. So that is imperialism or neo-imperialism. And for 400 years, the European and North American and later on the Japanese powers have expropriated the land, the labor, the resources, the wealth, and distorted and retarded the development of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. This, by the way, solves a mystery right here as to why in the last 40 years, as investments have increased in the third world, so has poverty. We've been hearing for 40 years how the North must help the South, go in there and bring them technology and help develop them with investments and such. And in fact, as those investments come in, what you get is more poverty, not less poverty. The condition of people in the third world today is worse than it was in 1940. The condition of the Maya Indians today in Guatemala is worse than it was 400 years ago before the Spaniards came. Before the Spaniards came, they had better land, they had corn, they had game, they had a better diet, they had a better level of social development than they do have today. Because the imperialist power goes into that country not to develop the people there. It's not in the business of philanthropy. It's not in the business of helping these poor, little, brown, black, and yellow people who somehow just can't seem to get it together. People who had civilizations that are hundreds of years older than European civilization. People that had universities. People that had their own villages and their own townships and their own mines and their own mills and their own industries and their own trade. And then the European powers went in there and destroyed it or expropriated it and took it and imposed the poverty on those people. The investing power goes in that country to make money off it. It's not like the U.S. investing in Great Britain or the Japanese investing in the U.S. It's a very particular dependent form of capitalism. And development theory, as postulated by fools like Walter Rostow and Barbara Ward in her book, The Rich Nations and the Poor Nations, development theory anticipated the following. It said very simply, this capital would come in and it would take workers from less productive sectors of society and bring them into more productive sectors. So the man and woman who worked with a hoe would now be driving a tractor. Productivity would go up, wages go up, consumption would go up, new markets would form, more developed, and the country would be on its way to development. That doesn't happen. What we've discovered in the last 40 years is that development isn't the goal of multinational corporations. Making profits is the goal, as it will be when they go into Poland and Hungary. It will be making profits for themselves, looking for bargain price, giveaway, privatized, denationalized industries, and then employing cheap labor and making as big and quick as possible a profit as possible. Excuse the redundancy. Okay, now what they do is they go in, expropriate the land, turn that land into cash crop exports. Land that used to be used to raise corn and beans to feed the people is now used to raise coffee and cotton and sugar and tobacco for cash markets for bigger profits. They go in and they dig out and they start a mining industry or oil industry or whatever else. They employ a very small portion of the people there, usually at low-paid service jobs. They bring in their own technologies, their own technicians. They take full advantage of all the subsidies which they extract from the host country. They take full advantage of all the tax breaks, in fact, pay almost no taxes. And they then repatriate the profits and the wealth from that country. Sometimes they come in with all the materials of the thing and just simply employ the labor at slave wages, literally bringing down everything into a country like El Salvador, where you have Firestone and Goodyear and Pillsbury and General Motors and General Electric and Chase Manhattan, all of them down there in El Salvador, a little country that has nothing in it. No, just a little sugar, a little bananas, but it has that other commodity of production that's the most important commodity. The one that does not consume its own value in the form of production, but in fact creates surplus value, and that's labor. And the corporations have a name for that. They call that outsourcing, where you literally bring all the stuff down and you hire the Salvadoran labor. Instead of hiring people in Ohio or Pennsylvania or Colorado, you go down to El Salvador where you can pay them 50 cents an hour. And it literally compensates for all the shipping costs and shipping in and shipping out. And you bring it all down there and those people work and they make energy rods and computers and air conditioners and rubber tires and all sorts of other things. None of which, baking powder, baby powder, name it. None of which is consumed by the people of El Salvador. Their labor is just ripped off at subsistence wages and then it's taken out for enormous profits. And the people are left with the hole in the ground where the copper or the coal once was. And the people are left huddled around the edges of these great sugar and coffee latifundios, living in poverty and hunger. That's why you don't have development. You may have maldevelopment. You may have underdevelopment. After the British went into India and began to invest in India, and what they did was destroy the great textile centers of India in Madras and Dhaka, and force the Indians back into raising cotton, turn India back into a cow that would be milked for its raw materials. The per capita of India from 1850 to 1900 fell by two-thirds, by 67%. And that's what poverty in the third world is all about. It's not that people just don't know how to work. that people just can't get it together? People work harder in the third world than they work anywhere else if they're fortunate enough to work. It's not that they lack a Protestant ethic. They work systematically, and they've worked for centuries and built whole civilizations before the Europeans and the capitalists ever came. It's that they are in an enforced poverty. But that poverty serves well the rich accumulation of wealth that goes to the ruling interests of the Western world. And by the way, the overhead costs of that empire are paid by the ordinary people of the Western world. We pay the taxes. We pay for the fleet in the Persian Gulf. And again, you see, mysteries are cleared up. Because when Reagan sent that fleet into the Persian Gulf during the Iran-Iraq war, and it was pointed out that it's costing us $2 for every $1 of oil that's being taken out, people were saying, that's irrational. But empire isn't irrational, because that $1 of oil belonged to the corporations, and Reagan was being sure that it got out and was getting to the markets, even though the markets weren't American markets. The markets were Japanese and French, for the most part. But it wasn't protecting our oil, it was protecting the oil of the Seven Sisters, the big corporations. And they'll spend $2 of your money to protect $1 of their money. They'll spend $5 of your money, $10 of your money to protect $1 of their money. Money's no object when it's your money. Money's no object when it's a question of protecting their money. So of course they'll do it. And it's not irrational. It's not foolish. It's a very rational thing. And one would wonder when the media will ever talk about that, when the media will ever present that analysis. I maintain that you can't present that analysis, that the media pundits, the media columnists, the media commentators, the editorial writers, the publicists and all cannot talk about that, because if they wrote that, they couldn't get it published. If they said that on the air, that would be the end of them. And most of them, first of all, don't even have the awareness that, or would even not allow themselves the awareness of even broaching the subject in that way at that level. So imperialism remains remarkably the unspoken subject. Even as it bursts forth in wrenching violence before your very eyes, the media will present it to you right in front of your eyes. They'll call it El Salvador. And they'll say, Marxist guerrillas are fighting in El Salvador. But they won't tell you what's that all about. Why are those people fighting? The assumption is that you should already know that there are bad guys who want to do bad things, and there are good guys supported by the United States who want to stop those bad things. And that's what it's all about. And by the way, that's where the entertainment media comes in very handily, because it's one of the major themes of entertainment shows is just that. They're the external bad force that wants to come in. I'll talk about that later on. My reference to El Salvador should remind us that there are, in fact, whoever invented this lectern ought to invent it. Gore. What a joke. Yeah. If you heard growling back, yeah. Let's see if that will do. Can you hear that? Is that all right?
All right. Whew.
David, you can't move this at all? Just an inch? I mean, just getting claustrophobic here. Okay. Now, that development, that intrusion into the third world was never received with open arms. The entertainment media would have you think otherwise. I was raised on John Hall, Maria Montez movies. There's only about 15 people in this audience who remembers those movies. But 16, okay, so your hand go up. It's an interesting way. The white man comes to the idyllic island, and the friendly natives greet them. And they're friendly, and the white hero, handsome white hero, falls in love with the chief's beautiful daughter named Momogo. And the crisis comes at a point where she, at one point, takes her tiny brown little fists and presses them against his great hairy mat of a chest and says, "No, no, your people are not my people. I can't go back with you to Bloomington, Indiana." And he says, "Come on, Momoga, Ma and Pa would just love you." And that's what the whole movie's about. These islands are open islands, or sometimes there are no people at all, just wild beasts, and you settle it and you build a little home and all that sort of thing. In fact, in all these places, there was fierce and desperate resistance by the people in them. And in all these places, force and violence was used to subdue them. And that, by the way, is something that you should also remember, that for 400 years, you had this kind of terrible oppression and war and destruction. And yet, imperialism, this development theory, so-called, is represented as a natural kind of thing. It's a natural thing that some countries would have machinery and other countries would have plantations, you know, and some countries would have this and other countries people would just sit out in the sun singing all day. That's just sort of a natural thing. And what strikes you when you read the history of imperialism, read a great book like L. S. Stavrianos' book called Global Rift. Read a less great but maybe more accessible book like mine called The Sword and the Dollar. What strikes you is the unnatural, the forced development, how force and violence had to be used, that this civilization, this global civilization, which they say is a natural development of nations, was really developed with the whip and the sword and the gun and the Gatling gun and the gunboats and the helicopter gunships, as they're using now, and the jet planes and the napalm and that sort of thing. Really quite unnatural. This, I maintain, is why the U.S. is in all these various countries. This is why the United States has 150 bases all around the world. This is why it has its navy in all the oceans of the world. This is why it's now fighting wars in Angola and in Mozambique and in Afghanistan and in El Salvador and in Nicaragua right now. The U.S. is engaged in fighting wars. Advisors are there, Green Beret specialists are there, the armies that are out in those fields, the guerrillas or the counter-revolutionaries, the Contras of Afghanistan and the Contras in Mozambique and Angola and Nicaragua, and the government forces in El Salvador. In each of those cases, they are armed, equipped, trained, advised, and paid by the United States government. In each of these cases, they're in those countries to make sure that competing social orders do not develop, that the people in those countries do not take over and begin to use the land, the labor, the resources, and technology in a different way, a way that would be very costly to global capitalism in general and to the multinationals specifically. One could say, well, what's all the fighting about? I mean, what's the use of fighting against capitalism in these countries when you develop, you take over, and after a while, your people want to go capitalist anyway, as is happening seemingly in Eastern Europe and other places? Well, first of all, a lot of the agitation in Eastern Europe is not necessarily anti-socialist as it is anti-communist party, that is, against a party that has a monopoly of power and has, in fact, gotten stagnant, privileged, and much of what's called anti-socialism is really against the corruption and the privileges and the non-responsiveness of certain ruling elites in these countries. It doesn't mean for a moment that these people are prepared to give up the social wage, the great historical accomplishments of socialism, free education, the subsidized prices for food and all that sort of thing. They are having to give them up, as they are in Poland, and they're learning the hard way what the blessings and wonders of capitalism are. In any case, that's not the question in the Third World. The question is not what's going to happen in some future generation. Will it be a capitalist form of development or a socialist form of development? The question is, can these countries get the jackboot of imperialism off their necks? Can they get the foreign expropriator off their neck? And can they come to the point where the people of the country can use their resources in a social way? And if the people of that revolutionary country decide to bring in the corporation, as the Vietnamese have just done, they bring in oil companies to do the offshore drilling, but they bring them in on their terms, and they get a chunk of the wealth back, which is something they didn't get before. Their country is no longer a cow that's just milked mercilessly by foreign interests. Their country now belongs to them, and they can share in the development and share in the profits and reinvest those back into the development of their country. And that's the difference, and that's what these people are fighting for. And that really is what the U.S. is fighting against. How else do you explain U.S. interventionism throughout the world? What are the alternative explanations? that the United States has gone in to defend democracy? Well, that can't be, because we supported dictatorships in most of these countries. We supported a fascist Somoza in Nicaragua, a fascist Batista in Cuba. Again and again, country after country, we didn't support democracy, we support fascism. And in fact, we've overthrown democracies. We overthrew democracy in Guatemala when Arbenz came into power. We overthrew democracy in Brazil when Goulart came into power. We overthrew democracy in Chile when Allende came into power. We overthrew a populist government leader, Mossadegh in Iran and Sukarno in Indonesia, who had popular democratic support. In each case, in each one of those countries, different leaders, different countries, different histories, different languages, different cultures, but they all had one thing in common. They were beginning to use the political system to tamper with and change the economic and class structure. What Allende was doing in Chile, very democratically, was redistributing some of the gross national income from those who made money from dividends and interest and commissions and rents to those who made money from wages and salaries. Unemployment went down in Chile. Inflation was going down. The rate of inflation was going down. Buying power was increasing for the ordinary people. Popular consumption was increasing. The level of living was bettering in a modest way for the people. Every child in Chile was getting a half a liter of milk under the Allende regime. And when the fascist Pinochet came in, that was one of the first programs he abolished. And in Guatemala, and Arbenz, when he came into office, he legalized all opposition parties. He legalized all opposition, all trade unions, all opposition newspapers, all student organizations, which were very political in Guatemala at the time. And then he began to expropriate the unused land from the United Fruit Company. And that's when the CIA went in with a mercenary army, trained by and equipped and financed by the CIA, and overthrew him. It wasn't that he threatened democracy, is that he was using democracy, he was using political democracy to effectuate an economic democracy. And that economic democracy is the thing that privileged classes have hated all their lives. If you go back to ancient Greece, if you look at our founding fathers and the debates at the Constitutional Convention, they talk about the leveling impulse, the common people wanting a bigger share of what we have. And they don't want to give up what they have. They don't want to give it up. They'll fight and kill to keep it. No more than you want to give up your little car or your house or whatever little you got. You don't want to give it up. Imagine if you didn't just own a little car. Imagine if you owned the world. Imagine if you owned everything there was to own. Imagine if you lived like a king. Imagine if you lived in a way that the whole society was there for your service, in a sense. To give that up is the worst tyranny of life. And much of what is called freedom has that class anchorage in it. You can talk to those people who are displaced from revolutionary countries, and they will tell you of the horror of socialism, the horror of revolution. They'll tell you how this Committee for the Defense of Revolution comes in and says, you have five houses, you have to give up four of those houses now, because we have people who are homeless, and they're going to live in those houses. Can you imagine that? That my houses, the houses that have been in my family for three generations, that were given to us by my grandfather, Generalissimo Thug, are going to be taken now. And he says, you have 12 servants, we have a labor shortage, you can only keep the two oldest ones. And the other 10 must go out on the labor market because we need them for work. Can you imagine they tell me, my servants, that are like my children? Are they part of my family? I love them. They love me. Ave Maria. They're going to take my servants away from me. You call that freedom? The tyranny. And they tell me I have to double the wages of my workers. Who are they to tell me how much I pay my workers? I decide that. I mean, the rage about this. And when my senora and I want to go on our shopping trips, as we do every year, to Paris and London and Miami, they say, no, you can't take any currency out of the country. You call that being free? They tell you you can't travel anymore? And then they give me a ration book? And I get online with my Mercedes. I have to get online for 5 gallons of gasoline. Where could you even go for 5 gallons of gasoline? And in front of me is this little truck with chickens all over it and the dirt and the feathers all over. I have to wash my car again after I'm on that ration line. I mean, it's disgusting. You call that being free? You call that being alive? And so finally, what do, my senora and I? We give it all up. We're so disgusted with it. And we move to Miami, where we can be free. And our picture is taken in the Miami Herald. And we see freedom finally. Freedom to choose. Kmart. Bloomingdale's. Freedom of a wide spectrum of opinion now. NBC, ABC, CBS. Enormously wide, diverse media opinion. Different perspectives, different viewpoints, different ideological points. All sorts of unusual information and depth of analysis, right? No, that was being ironic, right? And they say they're free. And the Miami Herald is a picture of them burning their ration card. But that ration card for the campesino in that country, that ration card is an important democratic victory. That's democracy that's won. But that ration card, the demos, the ordinary people in that country, have now got some guarantees. With that ration card, he means he's never going to hear his kids crying of hunger again, because he knows rationing like nobody else. Because he had the other rationing, the earlier rationing, the rationing of the free market. When your kids cried, when if you didn't have the money, you were rationed, that's all. You don't think for a minute you're not rationed. You're rationed every day. You ration yourself every day. If you don't think so, just stop and listen to yourself saying it. What'll I do? Should I spend that or that? Or I gonna that? How much would that cost? And then was that? You're always being rationed. The free market is a rationing of its own. The ration card is a democratic rationing. It's a leveling rationing. It says the guy with the Mercedes and this campesino both are going to get a certain amount of powdered milk, a certain amount of beans, some sugar, some other foods, some canned foods, whatever else. His kids get a pair of shoes every year so they don't get hookworm. That's something he never had before. And that's why he supports that revolution. And he fights for that ration card. And that revolution, for all its mistakes and all its crimes, and may even commit crimes at times when it's being attacked on two fronts, who says it's infallible. And for all its long lines and waiting and everything else, for all the struggle, he supports and he stays with that revolution because that's all he's got. Because the idea of going back to slavery, the idea of going back when he couldn't read, the idea of going back to hear his kids crying of hunger again is something he will not do. He prefers to fight and struggle for that. That's what it's about. And the media would never tell you that story, and they would never allow me on the media to tell you that story. We have freedom of speech as long as we're in small rooms like this. But the democratic forces of this society have not penetrated corporate power. And as long as we don't penetrate and we haven't been able to challenge and break into that corporate power which controls and preempts the audiences of 20 and 30 and 40 million, that corporate power will give you George Will, snotty little preppy, William Buckley, snotty little ruling elitist, McLaughlin, that right-wing boor, Evans and Novak, two more right-wing boors. And you can go on. And your opinion is from the far right over to a kind of a pale, wishy-washy, simpy, centrist view, liberalish view. I mean, your farthest left you can go in the media is maybe an occasional Tom Wicker comment. Or William Leo Grande, my friend William Leo Grande. I hate to put him down. He's a personal friend of mine. But I heard him the other night on McNeil Air. He says, What is this going on in El Salvador? The announcer says to him, "What is?" Oh, it's always a big pop. What is this going on? He said, "Well, we just seem to think we can hoist our system onto these people, graft it onto these cultures and societies that where it won't take." You see, well, that's what's wrong. We're giving them democracy, and they can't do it. That's what it's about. I'm saying, Jesus, this is the left. That's the left perspective. That's as far left as you can go. Well, I say democracy in El Salvador is in the streets. Democracy is there among those people who are fighting against vastly superior firepower to get rid of this jackboot of imperialism that's on their neck. Well, no, we go into these countries to prevent leftist governments from arising. These guerrillas are Marxists, and the media will say it every day. Marxist guerrillas, that's what they're called. First of all, probably two or three of the FMLN groups. There are five groups in it with five parties and five armies coordinating together. It's a front. The FMLN is a political front. Two, possibly three of them would not call themselves Marxist. Two would. Probably the two most effectively organized ones would. Okay. But let's say they are Marxist. Why do you say that every day? And what does that mean? What does it mean to say they are leftist guerrillas? Could we open up some doors, maybe get some air in here? One of the rules in colleges is to make sure everything's overheated and as hot as possible. What does it mean to be leftist? And why are the right-wing governments friendly to us? What does it mean to be right-wing? What does it mean to be left and right? Are these just two global cults and you kind of just join one or the other? Is that it? And say, maybe I'll join the left because I'm left-handed. What is it? What are they? What does it mean to be left? To be left means that you want to affect changes in the economic structure of a country, in the class structure of that country. To be right means that you want to keep the existing status quo, where 80% of the wealth is owned by and controlled by 2% of the population, plus foreign investors. That's what left and right means. If that isn't what it means, you tell me what it means. Well, the right is also religious and the left is atheist. Well, that's not true. All through Latin America, we find priests getting killed because they're left. And their sin is that they're subversivos. How do you say it? Subversives. I can't say it. My Spanish is non-existent and I shouldn't pretend. They're subversives. And why are they subversive? What's the charge? By the way, that's the charge right now as to why certain people are being targeted and being killed. The charge is they are working among the poor. They are guilty of working with the poor. That's an amazing charge. What you're supposed to do as a priest is work among the rich. And there are plenty of priests who do work among the rich. Le prêtre de double menton. My French is a little better. The priest of the double chin, the French call that, right? The prelate who's always there to bless the cathedral and bless the mansions and bless the generals and bless the troops. There are plenty of those priests, but now we're getting other priests who are working among the poor, and they're getting shot dead like criminals in streets. So you can't say the left is atheistic. The left seems to have more clergy on its side than the right does. Well, we're there supposedly because the leftists are hostile to us. I don't see them as hostile to us. If they have anything in common, all these left governments and countries and movements, is they want friendly relations with the U.S., whether it's the Soviet Union or Vietnam or Cuba or little mini micro Grenada when it was under the New Jewel Movement or the Nicaraguan government or the El Salvadoran guerrillas have actually called for friendly relations with the U.S. and asked them to mediate and have a ceasefire repeatedly. By the way, again, underreported in the media. One thing they all have in common is they want normal economic, diplomatic, and political relations with the U.S., a point that's very much underreported. Well, we're there to defend national interests and national security. By the way, that's a really fabulous concept, national interest, because it's never defined. You can go through piles and piles of State Department reports, public speeches by our leaders, and media stories, and you'll find no one ever defines what our national interests are. I just heard McNeil there the other night, and they're talking to someone from the State Department saying the U.S. vital interests in Central America, our national interests, national security interests in Central America necessitate our playing a role there, blah, 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 blah. And not a reporter says, what are our interests? When you say our interests, what do you mean, our? You know, I always like that word, our interests. I used to hear about our oil in the Middle East. Our oil. And I got very excited one day, and I ran to my filing cabinet and pulled out to get my stock portfolio to see how much oil stock I owned. And I discovered, much to my dismay, I didn't even have a stock portfolio, let alone oil stock. But they kept saying it's our oil, which is going to be paid for by our taxes and our sons, and maybe our daughters will go off and get blown away to protect their oil. Well, the rule of the news media, the absolute, pretty much absolute, almost absolute rule is you never say anything positive about any revolutionary government or movement, except when you think it might be moving toward capitalist restoration. Then you say, oh, they're becoming to their senses. But you almost, I would say almost never, I say almost never because I do remember in 1978 reading an article in the New York Times that said the Hungarian communist government at that time, still communist, had a very good bus system in Bucharest. So occasionally, you might get an article, very occasionally. I once saw another article about how the city planner in Managua wanted to plant lots more trees in Managua, Nicaragua. That's about it I could say, having read an average of 700 or 800 publications, periodicals, newspapers a year. I read about 700 or 800. I just sat and estimated one day. I think those are the two in my memory that were ever positive. Generally, you can never say anything positive. It's always, they are in bad shape, they're terrible, the people are starving. Positive features like land reform, like health clinics, or even those things are framed as negative, that is, they're communist ploys to win popular support. Communists do not really want the power to end hunger, they just hunger for power. That is the image that you got. That these guys just fight and go out there and die and kill against vastly superior, get killed against vastly superior firepower because they want to get power themselves. If they wanted to get power themselves, why would they take such a costly, horrendous, circuitous route to power? Why don't they just suck up to power and serve power and enlist with the powers that be, which is the way all other power climbers and power grabbers do, is the way people do in our society right here. Along with that, what you always get in the media are positive framings of client states of U.S. imperialism. By client states, I mean those states which have opened up their land, resources, and markets to total U.S. capital penetration, where the leader says, come on in, boys, here it is, it's all for you, take it. And there's no environmental protection laws, there's no minimum wage laws, there's no pensions, there's no Social Security, there's no occupational safety you have to worry about, any of that stuff, come on in, it's wide open, it's all yours, we waive taxes for the next 30 years on you, we'll even put up some of the equity, give you the land, and even give you some of the seed capital, whatever else, come on in, boys, it's all yours, and in return, all you do is you take care of me, my family, my boys, and if they try to organize and get out of line, we'll crack their heads with our civil guards, our police, whatever else, who are trained and equipped by you with the aid that you send in, and make sure you give me a couple of the factories. And that's a U.S. client state, and there are a lot of them. But they're always portrayed as positively in the U.S. media. They're portrayed as staunch allies, as firmly in the Western camp, and that sort of thing. Let's take the case of El Salvador. Ladies and gentlemen, El Salvador has lost 50,000 people have been killed in the last decade. 50,000 people. It would be like about 4 or 5 million here. Killed by their own government. Most of those people, 90% of those people have been killed by their own government. And they are people who have protested, who oppose things. They are people who would have very much liked to have done what the Poles did against the power-hungry, power-crazy communists in Poland. They would have liked to get rid of a government by demonstrating in the streets. And in fact, they used to demonstrate in the streets in El Salvador. And you know what used to happen? They started getting machine gunned. And it's really uncomfortable to demonstrate when you're getting machine gunned. And it's very upsetting. And so eventually you come back and your people get killed. You try to organize and your leaders get killed. 50,000 of them, labor leaders, student leaders, peasant leaders, intellectuals, writers, clergymen, killed. Because they talked up for the poor. And in that time, El Salvador today is now called a democracy. This is a country that has had this kind of massive massacre, and it is referred to as a democracy by the media. It's referred to by our political leaders as a democracy. Doesn't that boggle your mind? Isn't that something to say in 1984 there were democratic elections in El Salvador between Roberto Dabusson, who was head of the death squad, And his opponent was Jose Napoleon Duarte, who was an apologist for the death squad. I mean, I saw the guy on videotapes. I saw a film where he kept talking about this is all exaggerated, we're doing fine, the subversives have to be stopped, it's necessary. That's Duarte, and he's called the moderate. I mean, doesn't it boggle your mind that today, a McNeil Lair, I heard it, this is supposed to be the best news show we have. The announcer from there, a guy named Kraus, is saying the Salvadoran guerrillas are a sectarian terrorist group. They're trying to provoke the far left in Mr. Cristiani's party to commit acts like killing those six Jesuits. So now the Jesuits were killed because they were provoked, the provocation. The real guilt is on the Salvadoran guerrillas. And Christianity is being buffeted by the extreme left and the extreme right. Christiani is called a moderate now. Doesn't that blow your mind a little bit? To hear this guy suddenly transformed by the magic of words, by the magic of labels, by the magic of media, he's a moderate now. Wasn't that something to take this deranged murder machine? This butcher, fascist, torturing murder machine that specialized in gorging people's eyes out and cutting men's genitalia out while they were still alive and cutting women's breasts off and raping them while they were still alive? Isn't it something to have it transformed by this U.S. media into a democracy, a fledgling democracy, a showcase democracy, a budding democracy, a precious democracy? I mean, that's a propaganda feat, that transformation that outdoes anything Dr. Joseph Goebbels did in Nazi Germany. By 84, never to mention, to cover a whole election in El Salvador and never mention that there was no secret ballot in the voting. That when you went in to vote, you put your name on a roll and that roll number had a roll number, 172. And your ballot had a number called 172 and they voted and they could trace any, therefore, any vote of any person. To not mention that. To not mention that voting was compulsory in El Salvador, and to show people fighting to get in before the polls closed, trying to get the gates in. The Salvadorians are eager to exercise their rights in democracy. I said, what voters ever tried to get their arms broken, fighting and clawing to get in there to vote? Not to mention that if your schedule wasn't stamped that you had voted, you could be arrested and detained by the police. But to say, look at them, hungering to vote. Hungering to vote for Dabusson or Duarte? I can't believe it. Where did this enthusiasm come from? I mean, isn't that something? And this is the way El Salvador is reported to us. And that's called the neutral media. When you talk to these guys, they get defensive. They say, look, you left and you right ideologues. We goes out, we sees the story, we gets the story, and we writes the story. I said, oh, give me a break. I mean, I've heard this again and again. I've been on so many panels with reporters now. I can't tell you how they just, reporters, editors, they just pat themselves on the back. A damn good job we do. It ain't perfect, but we're the best there is around. And it's just sickening. And you say, how did you report El Salvador? And the commentary on it. Isn't it something also that in the past week you heard about the six Jesuit priests? And the evening news never mentioned that one of them wasn't a priest only. He was rector of an important university, University of Central America. Is this something he wasn't mentioned? And another of the six victims was vice rector. And in the past week, by the way, I just heard, I live in Washington. One of the advantages of living in Washington is you get a lot of stuff comes in directly by phone, different groups. And if you know the people in the groups, you can get it. And this past week, I got from Neighbor to Neighbor, which right now is a national organization that has worked very hard in lobbying Congress to kill aid, stop the Contra war against Nicaragua, and now they're working full-time on El Salvador. They have been over the past year, not just in response to the recent events, but they've been working over the past year lobbying Congress to stop aid to the Salvadoran murder machine. And I talked to someone in the office, and this is what I got. Besides the six Jesuits who were killed, now being framed as an isolated incident, an excessive act. By the way, none of the military, the media is reporting that the government hasn't interviewed any military about the killings. But besides that, at least 100 trade unionists have been arrested and have disappeared. At least several for sure have been killed. Almost all popular leaders have gone into hiding. These are very hurried notes, which I wrote just the night before I came out here yesterday. Almost all popular organizations have been wiped out or have themselves gone underground. Archbishop Rivera y Damas, who is Romero's successor, you remember Romero was executed by a Dabusson death squad, and auxiliary bishop Rosa Chavez have received death threats. A Lutheran church, which was served as a sanctuary for people during the fighting in areas which were indiscriminately bombed by the Air Force, bombing their own people, a Lutheran church was bombed itself. A dozen Lutheran church workers have been arrested, including internationals and Salvadorans. The Lutheran bishop, Madardo Gomez, is in hiding after death threats, and he has now left the country. Mennonite's office have been raided, and Mennonite workers have gone underground or been arrested. Father Daniel Sanchez, Roman Catholic Church, Mother Mary of the Poor, Mother Mary of the Poor, that's a subversive name right there. The military came in and started shooting at Father Sanchez's feet and threatened to bomb the church. Instead, they occupied it and used it as a military headquarters during the fighting over the past 2 weeks. 13 Episcopalians, clergy and lay church workers, including Father Luis Serrano, have been badly beaten and tortured, and others have been held incommunicado and tortured by the national police. The head of the Jesuit Refugee Service, Father Dick Howard, who had been detained earlier last week when he was taking, ready for this, the subversive thing he was doing? He was caught taking food to people in poor neighborhoods that hadn't seen food in days during the bombing and the fighting. He was arrested. His food was confiscated. Baptist missionary Jean Mooney was picked up in Santa Ana, and we don't know where she is now. Jennifer Casola, a lay church person, this has made the media, hasn't it, who coordinates, you know, they found arms in her backyard. They dug up the backyard, they claim, and they found guns and all sorts of things underground. By the way, it's a bad, very bad way to store arms underground. Well, it's really bad for the ammunition and everything else like that. Her job has been for a number of years as a lay church person coordinating ecumenical delegations into El Salvador. That's what this armed revolutionary did. And she has been threatened repeatedly and was widely known to have been under surveillance. Friends of hers asked her not to return to El Salvador, but she did. The police have arrested her, and they claim she's hidden these huge amounts of arms, and she's being held. Neighbor to Neighbor now is launching, with the support of several of the surviving El Salvadoran trade unions, UNTES, COASES, ASTEL, the executive board of CICAFE, these are all acronyms. The CICAFE is the Coffee Processing Workers Union. They all support a boycott of Salvadoran coffee. So I would ask you also, if you want to know, one of the favorite questions in any lecture, what can we do? What can we do? Here, I'm giving you something right now. To boycott Salvadoran coffee. This boycott is formally being endorsed by actors Michael Farron, Ed Asner, numbers of other people. CSPIS supports it, Share, Creche, National Sanctuary Network supports the boycott. Salvadoran coffee is sold in the blends of Folgers, Maxwell House, Nestle's, Hills Brothers, MJB, Chase, and Sanborn. So if you want further information, you have this 900 number. 900, don't buy, that's the number. It's the first commercial I've ever done in the middle of a lecture, but I think it's for a worthy purpose. People are dying in El Salvador, and they're fighting with tremendous courage there right now, and we should give them all the support we can. In any case, coffee is a filthy, dirty, dangerous drink. Caffeine is an addiction, and you should rid yourself of that anyway. And so don't drink it. And don't drink the decaffeinated stuff either, especially Folgers. Got Folgers, Maxwell House, Nestle's. Those things have an effect. There's nothing you do that's too little. Signing a petition, writing a letter, there's nothing you do that's too little that isn't important. It's important. You may think it's futile, you may think it's not, but it's important. Do it, do it. We had that all during the Vietnam War. We used to have that. What's the use of working for Eugene McCarthy? What's the use of signing these petitions? What's the use of marching in the streets? What's the use? Do those things. Do them. Do them. Every kind of line of pressure that you can do is an important and vital thing. And believe me, they are very concerned about that all the time. Another media myth is the myth of benign capitalism. This myth of benign capitalism, by the way, has been strengthened very recently by developments in Eastern Europe, where media commentators are now having the opportunity of associating democracy with capitalism. Even Mikhail Gorbachev, I'm sorry to say, just 2 days ago, quoted in the Washington Post as saying that capitalism, whatever its faults, is to be credited with, quote, the rule of law and, quote, prosperity in some places. I would point out that the rule of law is not a capitalist achievement. The rule of law is a democratic achievement. That if you look at the history of this democracy, it was people agitating and fighting for 200 years to get the vote, to get restrictions put on the big companies, to get them to answer to the law. That's a fight that's still going on today as far as pollution and environment goes. The rule of law is something that comes from the people who might benefit from the law. And the rule of law was something that was always scoffed by those who felt themselves as being above the law. The rich believed themselves above the law, and the poor have felt themselves too far beneath the law to use it. Just remember that quote by, was it, I don't remember if it was Jay Gould or J.P. Morgan or Nelson Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller I, saying that the law is something to catch the little bugs and the little spiders, but us big ones just plow right through it like a cobweb. It's nothing for us. Back in the late 1800s, the robber barons used to speak more candidly about their powers than they do today. They've learned not to speak so brashly about it. But that's still true today. The rule of law is something we have developed, not under capitalism, because of capitalism, but despite capitalism, and often hemming in and restricting capitalism. And so with prosperity, with all due respect for the really fine work that Mikhail Gorbachev is doing, especially in undermining the whole arms race and such, prosperity, it depends on what capitalist countries you're talking about. If you talk to people in Eastern Europe today, and even in the Soviet Union, and even a lot of other countries throughout the Third World, they will tell you about America. There's no poverty in your country. The poorest among you live better than the average people in our country. If your people are poor, it's just because they're lazy. If you tell them there are people who sleep on gratings, there are people who dig through garbage dumps for food, they literally will not believe you. And they know it's not true. And they believe it and they have it right up here with all the certainty of inexperience. They know where they're going to go. They've seen the future, and the future are these free markets. And the Poles have wanted this for a long time, and the Poles are now getting it. And they're getting it right up the kazoo. They're getting it. The price controls have been dropped from food and basics, and inflation in Poland today is now 50% per month. That's 600% a year. Unemployment has come in. You've stopped the feather bedding, giving everybody the right to a job. You pad your workforce, it's true. You kick people out, okay, but you got unemployment now. You got hunger in Poland today. The LA Times had an article a few weeks ago about hunger in Poland. People wanting bread, about a baker was selling his bread at cost because he was so sorry for people who were so hungry. And instead of the hungry people coming, all sorts of speculators came in buying up the bread. They smashed his windows with the press of the crowd against it so they could then go out and sell the bread at a profit. They're learning the American way. And there's a fascinating quote, I wish I had it, from Lech Wałęsa. It was in the Gannett Publishing, Westchester newspaper. He said, to those who were complaining about the unemployment and the inflation, he said, you wanted the American way? We got American way. This is the way we do it. Now stop complaining. This is what it's about. So they're going to learn about it. They're going to learn the hard way about the blessings of the free market. But prosperity, indeed, there's no denying prosperity in capitalist countries. If you're talking about West Germany, if you're talking about Sweden, if you're talking about the U.S., but those are countries, especially the European ones, where capitalism has not been that successful, where capitalism has been hemmed in by democracy, where democratic forces have won important democratic victories, victories like occupational safety, like the social wage, like human services, like guaranteed pensions, and all these sort of things which cut into the profit motive. If you want to see capitalism as its most successful, because the essence of capitalism, you judge the essence of a system by what it does. And what capitalism does, the essence of the system, is capital accumulation. Then you must look at Honduras. And then you must look at Guatemala and Brazil and Zaire, where the value-added profit levels are 200 and 300 and 400% higher than they are in Western Europe. and North America, which is why these corporations abandon our communities and export our jobs to those areas, as I just discussed before. That's where capitalism is successful. So if you want to know about capitalism and its success, yeah, look at it. Look at capitalist Honduras. Look at capitalist Guatemala. Look at capitalist Indonesia. But again, the media doesn't treat capitalism that way. Right now you have in the media, in all the reports, implicit in all the news reports, implicit or explicit in the commentaries, is equating capitalism with prosperity and democracy. And they will report Gorbachev's remarks approvingly and will not comment critically on them as I have. And people who would comment critically on those remarks as I have do not have access to the media. There are no left commentators in the mainstream media. Left commentators are not allowed in the mainstream media. You just don't get in. I mean, I get on Crossfire a couple of times and C-SPAN. I've been on CNN once, on cable NBC, to discuss what is communism, you know, with two guys screaming at you from each side and that sort of thing. But, I mean, a regular access, you do not have it. The only left commentator, the whole left in America is truncated. That whole analysis, all that information I'm giving you, all that history that we might have, all that kind of background, all that unreported information, all that is kept out. Those commentators aren't in. The only one who's allowed in once a month, is Alexander Coburn. He has an 800-word column in the Wall Street Journal once a month. And I asked him about it once. We were on a plane together flying to a little commuter plane to Chicago. And I said, how come the Wall Street Journal gave you a column, Alexander? He said, well, they see me as kind of an oddity, you know, kind of like a weirdo nut. And they even complain that my columns sound too reasonable sometimes. They said, you know, why don't you say more things like, you know, support the Red Army invading France or something. You know, get some real. They say, you're getting predictable. Can't you say something? I think they want me to say really crazier stuff, you know. Let me just take a few minutes and then I'll end it to say something about the entertainment media. I'm now writing a book. I've just almost finished the book. It's called Make Believe Media. And it's about the politics and images of the entertainment media. And what I found there is that imperialism is described in the entertainment media. You do find it again and again. But it's described backwards. What you get is what Tom Engelhardt called the wagon train or the wagon circle paradigm. When movie after movie, especially in the 30s and 40s and 50s, even later on, you saw imperialism in action, and what it was always is a wagon circle. It could be a wagon circle or a fort or an encampment. It could be in the American West, or it could be in the Sudan or the Transvaal or in some Asian jungle or someplace. And inside the encampment are the human beings, the white people. They're usually Americans. And they're very nice looking, and they talk, and you feel sympathetic for them, and they're really nice, and they smile, and they work hard, and they go along, and you get the human quality of them. And outside come the swarthy hordes. Red hordes, screeching Indians, Indians, redskins, or yellow, or black, or brown. The swarthy hordes come, and they attack the nice human beings. And the wagon train then turns into a wagon circle. And the white men know what to do. They level their rifles and they begin to kill large numbers of these human beings. Does everyone know this paradigm? Have you ever seen a movie like that? And the question comes up is, why are the swarthy hordes killing the nice white people? Is it to protect their lands and their herds and their townships and their families and their children? No, they kill them because that's just what they like to do, because they're bloodlusting, killing, and they like to come charging in. And they display this tremendous, almost suicidal courage, which, by the way, in the context of these movies, is not even defined as courage. If that kind of behavior was done by one of the white human beings, that would be called very courageous. But done by them, it's just further manifestation of their crazed, bloodlusting, subhuman, not caring about life as they come along, and they are mowed down in these great numbers. Occasionally, a white will get, with plaintive music, an arrow or something. Joe, look what happened. And everybody stops and they kind of pull it out and they nurse him. Or maybe one of the lesser characters will be killed to register upon the audience the savagery of these fanatical killings of these people. Now, the trouble with that paradigm is that it turns history on its head. It reverses the roles of victim and victimizer. It reverses the roles of usurper and usurped. It reverses the roles of murderer and murdered. If you really want to know the killing and the bloodlusting, just read. Just read what the Germans did in Southwest Africa. 80,000 Herero tribe. Cut down 60,000 of the 80,000 killed and the other 20,000 put into slave labor. Just read what the British did just about everywhere else from Ireland to India. Just read what the French did in Algiers and Indochina. Just read what the Portuguese did in Mozambique and Angola. Just read what the Spaniards did in Latin America. Just read what the U.S. did in Central America. The pacification by U.S. Marines in Haiti. The killings and the slaughter in the Philippines. Whole villages, men, women, and children put up on the rails of bridges and shot down until rivers were clogged with bodies done by U.S. troops to pacify whole provinces. Just read about the killings. Just read about what the Italians did in Libya. Read about all that. And by the way, when I say these people, the French, the Americans, the Germans, whatever else, I don't mean the ordinary people in the country. They were the ones conscripted and brought in to do this killing for the ruling interests of that country. No movie, there's no movies about that. I was raised on the movies that said the opposite. Now, when you kill and you plunder a people, you have to do two things, ideologically and psychologically speaking. You have to deny the humanity of your victims. They're subhuman, they're moral inferiors. John Wayne, in one of his horse operas, I quote, "There's humans and then there's Comanches." It says it all. I mean, it says it all. There's humans and then there's Comanches. Now, when I was a kid and I watched that movie, I just said, there's humans and then there's Comanches. The second thing you do is you ascribe all your crimes to them. You deny your own inhumanity and you accuse your victims of doing to you what you are doing to them. And that, by the way, is what you are seeing every night in the evening news, a variation of that on the reports from El Salvador too. Sometimes the imperialist extermination can take a more endearing form. I just saw an old videotape. By the way, this is the sloppiest research I ever done. I hate this crap. I would fast forward so many times or ask people about it, you know. But this one movie, I watched some of it. It was done in 1937. I had to watch this one. It was called Wee Willie Winky, and it starred cutesy little Shirley Temple. And Shirley Temple asked her grandfather, the British colonel, why was he so mad at Kodak Khan, leader of the warlike, quote, warlike tribes on India's border? And the colonel says, "Darling, we're not mad at Kodak Khan. England wants to be friends with all her peoples, you see? But if we don't shoot him, he'll shoot us." This is the George Bush approach to Central America. By the way, these defamatory stereotypes and images demonstrate the unholy marriage between imperialism and racism. A very interesting vocabulary if you read the serious literature what this presentation is essentially a racist presentation also. These darker peoples are, after all, less than human. That's racism. And the vocabulary of imperialism is very interesting. Kaffir, raghead, slope, gook. In 1857, Karl Marx wrote a column where he reported about the British officers who were crushing people in the Sepoy Rebellion, and he said the British officers said, we hanged, the British are big on hanging, you know, we hanged every nigger we found. Every nigger we found is what he called the Indians. Well, those terms, nigger, kaffir, gook, slope, raghead, those are the vocabulary of imperialism as well as of racism. And you see the joining of the two. I won't say that imperialism causes racism, but imperialism finds racism very functional. It activates it, it relies on it, and it propagates it and pushes it forward ever so much more. And even when imperialism is not of the violent sort, it can still permeate a film. I finally, by the way, saw a film about Africa that might have been different. For years, I've been going to see films, right? And I never saw a decent film about Africa. Now, Africa, there's 1,000 stories in Africa. There are stories about cultural conflict, about urbanization, about generational conflict, about tribal differences, about labor struggle. I mean, the stories of Africa. 2 years ago, 250,000 gold miners in South Africa, 250,000 went on strike. I thought it was a misprint. I thought it was 25,000. I couldn't believe it. When we have big strikes in our country, the Pittston miners or whatever else, the big oil strikes in Iran were 50,000. 250,000. And they don't have phone banks and computers, you know, and carpools and all. They got like nothing. With sheer courage, the level of organization and discipline from a people who supposedly are not ready for self-government. 250,000 of them went out on strike. Has there ever been a story about the strikes, about the enormous labor struggles in South Africa? Never. Has there ever been a film, a teleplay, a teledrama about it? There are 1,000 stories in Africa, cultural stories, stories of love, stories of hate. Also, it's a fantastic continent. So finally, Hollywood, in 1984, finally Hollywood rediscovers Africa. Up to then, all the African films had been Tarzan flicks or safari flicks. You know, the bold white explorers are going along, and the only Africans are the guys holding these boxes on their head. And occasionally, when the action is slow, one of them would slip off the edge of a cliff and go screaming to his death, and they'd look at, oh, poor devil, what was he carrying? You know? And now we see a film, and a film is made finally, a quality film, full-length feature, with stars in it, and it's called Out of Africa, and it stars two great African actors, Meryl Streep and Robert Redford. And I sit there and I watch this film, and the whole film turns out to be about a Danish literati, neurotic, upper-crust lady whose biggest concern is to hang on to her plantation and get it together in the sack with Robert Redford. That's what the whole film is about. And I'm sitting there and I'm saying, where are the Africans in this film? Are they there? There are some. And you kind of see them. They are sort of in the back, around the sides. And they have great lines like, is Sahib hungry? Does Sahib wish to eat today? Shall I cook for Sahib? And those are the lines. Those are the Africans. And finally, there's one scene where Robert Redford says to her, he says, I'm going to show you the real Africa, because he's been there a long time. He's kind of gone native a little. And he takes her, I say, oh God, at last we're going to see Africa in this film. And what does he do? He takes her up in this plane, and you see the same old tired shots of the giraffes and the zebras running around. Still no Africans. And I say, no wonder they call this film Out of Africa. There's nothing in Africa about it. Take even a good film, and I think I'm going to stop here. Let me give you this last example, and I'll wrap it up. A film which was really a good film, Gandhi. Gandhi was pretty good. It actually had a half-Indian actor playing, Ben Kingsley. His mother is Indian. And the principals in the plot were Indians. And it was a film about the Indians struggling under the leadership of Mahatma Gandhi for their independence against British colonialists. But you go through the whole film, and you see the Indians, this organization and courage and all that. Good, a real plus, I mean a real breakthrough. By the way, the better films almost always are independently produced or foreign produced. I mean, the Hollywood stuff is just impossible. This was a British made, I think. What's left out of the whole film is imperialism. What's left out is the political economy of imperialism. Nothing is said about why the British are there. What were they doing there? And what you get by the end of the film is 3.5 hours. You come to the conclusion that the British simply don't have the decency to go home when asked to go home because they like to walk around with their swagger sticks and lord it over people all the time. And that's what the film's about. They don't tell you that the poverty of India is related to the wealth of the British, that the East India Company and the Bank of England and other corporations make money, were making money. A comment could have been said, you are living off the sweat of us. You make money, you get rich, you don't want to let go of that enormous wealth and that enormous investment. That's what it's about. You could have said that. You could have worked it in, one angry character getting up and saying it, or Gandhi maybe leaning forward and suggesting it. You know? Quietly, non-violently. There is one, did anybody ever see Cobra? That was an interesting film with Sylvester Stallone, because that takes the paradigm and puts it right back in our cities, where you have the white people in a barricade here, and then you have the swarthy hordes. They're not necessarily swarthy. In fact, in Cobra, they were mostly white, but they were just low-life types. And there's this horrible gang in the city that's trying to take over the city and the country and the world. It's not clear which. And Cobra is Sylvester Stallone, and he's a detective, and he goes out, and he kills them. All. He doesn't believe in sissy things like arrest and incarceration and filing charges and all that. So he just would shoot people. He sets one of them on fire, and he says, "You have the right to remain silent," as he sets the guy on fire. He douses him with gasoline and sets him on fire. And he says, you have the right to remain silent. As Jay Leno said, that actors like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone deserve a lot of credit for having opened up the acting profession to people who couldn't get into it when speech was a requirement. Well, it's very clear, I won't go on, I could tell you about Rambo and all that, but you already know about Rambo. It's very clear that the entertainment media resembles the news media. In fact, it's getting harder and harder for me, as I study both in more detail, to tell the difference between them sometimes, that the line gets fuzzier and fuzzier. And what we have here is an ideology and an orthodoxy that cannot be challenged or threatened in any way. And yet it is challenged every day. Let me point out one of the most interesting things, the only interesting thing I found about George Bush's first State of the Union message. He got up in January of this year, and he said, "We have to overcome the Vietnam syndrome." And I thought that was very revealing, that he would bring that up again. The Vietnam syndrome, you see, it makes it sound like a psychological condition that we're suffering from. The Vietnam syndrome is that they cannot send American troops into places, and they have to do low-intensity warfare and be more covert about it and have to struggle to get aid bills out to support it. They can't have a free hand in protecting imperialist interests around the world, because American public opinion is against that kind of commitment, because Americans have been traumatized. They're suffering from a syndrome because of the Vietnam War. I'll tell you what the Vietnam syndrome was. The Vietnam syndrome was that we began to raise questions about the war. And then we began to question the leaders that produced that war. And then we began to question the system that produced those leaders. And that's what troubles them. The ruling class rules, but it does not rule quite in the way it wants. The power of the people is still there, and they are very conscious of the limitations of their power. So what we have to do is mobilize, agitate, educate ourselves, organize, fight back, talk back in every possible way we can. That's the end of my lecture. Thank you. Are we supposed to have questions? Where's Matt? Do we really want questions? Let's take a vote on that. How many people want questions? How many don't want questions? Oh, all right. All right, let's have a few. We'll have a few questions. Yeah. You have a question? Yes, miss. Would you please stand when you ask your question so people could hear you? Can videotapes of this talk be duplicated and sent out? Portions of this talk can be found in, Matt Chilson, where is he? Could you just bring those, those flyers up and just put them here on the stage, okay? People's Video does distribute audio and videotapes of my talks at cost. I mean, the audio tapes are, I think, $5, and the videotapes are $19, which is at cost. All the labor is donated, including mine. So you could have that. But as far as this particular talk, you should talk to that gentleman. I think he's going to give a copy to Left Hand Bookstore in Boulder. But you were vague as to whether they were going to reproduce it and sell it.
I don't know. They'll be loaning it. And if people want individual copies, we'll work something out.
Why don't they sell it? Why don't they sell them?
We just haven't gotten it yet.
Oh, okay. Well, audio tape. KGNU has taped this, and they're going to maybe play it, you think? They will play it. Talking to the news editor right here, so and he nods at Disney Media. So you could get an audio, maybe you could, will you be selling audio tapes? You don't sell, do you? KGNU will sell audio tapes of this lecture. Anybody else has a question? Yes, miss?
I just wondered what with the, it seems to me that the media is getting even more narrow.
Could you stand up and speak so people could hear you?
It seems to me that the media is getting even more narrow now that GE is, owns NBC and Time Inc. Has been bought out by Warner Corporation and all of that. Is there any hope at all? I know how hard it's been for you and the left, but what's even going to happen to the middle?
Well, I just did a. The question was with GE buying up NBC and all the other mergers. By the way, what's happening with the major media are giant corporations and they manifest all the same attributes of corporate America, which is high rate of merger, union busting, high profit levels, all that sort of thing. Do you think it's going to get even worse? Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, NBC is not likely to start doing a lot of critical studies of defense contracting when GE owns them. And I just was interviewed last night on KBX, and the announcer there, Alan Duma, was saying he once worked for NBC, and he said GE's presence was palpably felt on a number of issues, that they just had to watch themselves and what they said. So so that is a further restriction, most definitely. What we should do is everything we can to support alternative media like station KGNU. Is that the right? KGNU and alternative and dissident individuals on more commercial stations. Call in and voice your support for them. And written publications like The Guardian that comes out of New York, not the English Guardian, but the New York Guardian. The Nation in these times, Covert Action Information Bulletin, People's Daily World, Political Affairs, publications of that sort that one could, Progressive. By the way, I don't agree with 100% with any one of those, but they will give you alternative perspectives. And when I say alternative perspective, I don't mean an alternative preachment. This idea is, oh, you've got your left preachment. There's no preachment. There's no preachment if you say that 80% of the wealth of El Salvador is owned by 2% of the population and the U.S. is in there for certain interests. No, that's an empirical statement you're making. That's not a left fabrication. I can't help it if the world, the real world is Marxist, if the real world is left. It's not that we invented those facts, it's that those things are true. Now, either that's true or it's not true. But you can't just dismiss it and say, oh, well, that's a leftist viewpoint, isn't it? I mean, it's not like it's, you know, religious viewpoint or some other kind of culturalistic viewpoint or something. It's not a viewpoint as such. Those are empirical statements. Is this information correct? Is this analysis correct or isn't it? And it's not. And people immediately want to label it as left or whatever. It's not. In other words, we don't say these things because we're left. We happen to be labeled left because we say these things, because we see these things. That's the point. Yes, miss. Stand up and speak loudly. Sisterhood, come on, get up and hit it out.
It sounds like you're saying that the media is being controlled, and it's because of the corporations. But the corporations that are controlling the media don't really have that much at risk in places like El Salvador, so why aren't they reporting?
What do you mean they don't have that much at risk?
They don't have coffee fields or anything over there. What shouldn't they?
No, the Fortune 500 are in El Salvador, very well in El Salvador. But that's quite correct. It doesn't necessarily mean direct investment in the country. You don't only worry about that. You worry about any revolutionary transformation. The case of Grenada would be a perfect case. I mean, what the hell's in Grenada? There's nothing. And Ronald Reagan was correct when he said it's not a matter of nutmeg. He said that. He's right, because the only product you get out of Grenada is nutmeg. And you can get that nutmeg from Africa. But what it was, going into Grenada, crushing the New Jewel movement, kicking out the Cuban doctors, kicking out the Cuban teachers, calling the nation that sent doctors and teachers to the country the aggressor, and calling your nation that sent paratroopers and bombers in there the saviors and the Democrats. Going in there, you were serving notice on the entire Caribbean that if they try any kind of social transformation, any kind of social revolution, if they try this, this is what they're going to get. That's called containment. So you're right, there was very little direct investment in Grenada. But A, you go in to serve as an example. And B, once you go in, the dollar sometimes follows the sword. Sometimes the sword goes in to protect the dollar. Sometimes the dollar comes in after the sword has carved out a thing. One of the anticipations, which by the way hasn't proven very true, but one of the anticipations was that U.S. private industry would come swooping in, take over in Grenada, and have a field day on all the cheap labor. Unemployment in Grenada now has shot up back up to 30%. The New Jewel movement had it down to about 12%, and it's gone back up over 30% now. That's what private enterprise has done in Grenada. So you don't have to demonstrate that a specific corporation has a specific investment in a specific country. Aside from the fact that the Fortune 500 are in El Salvador up to their ears, I told you that already. I said they're out there doing the outsourcing and using the labor market. But aside from that, the thing is to keep a competing social system from developing, one that would, in the long run, attack or threaten the essential interests of capital accumulation, global capital accumulation. Yes, next question. Yes, ma'am.
The same sort of thing happened in Chile. I was in Chile and so happy at the time, if I may express myself clearly but not in a ladylike way, when literally the shit hit the fan. And I was...
Cut that!
I was arrested, handcuffed, and sat for hours and hours, held for 3 days until my complete innocence, but uselessness for struggling against what was going on, and seeing these enormous crates come in and with arms being unloaded all over the hotel entrance made in the USA. Mm-hmm. That was what calmed down a very fine experiment in liberal government in Chile.
Right, the question was that, I have to repeat it for the radio tape here, that there was a very fine experiment in liberal democratic government in Chile where they were trying through electoral and peaceful means to transform some of the economy. And this woman's personal experience was that when Pinochet destroyed that democracy, that the U.S. was firmly behind Pinochet. And that she actually saw herself bound, when she was bound and handcuffed and held incommunicado in a hotel, crates coming in all through the hotel, or after your incarceration, you saw these crates come in, and arms opened in the lobbies, and the crates would say, "Made in USA." Yeah. The U.S. complicity and support for the triumph of fascism in Chile is a matter of public record, although it's still denied. It's, by the way, still denied by many apologists. While we talk about soft on communism, we really should note that the U.S. is very, very, very soft on fascism. That it uses fascism to protect capitalism, all the while claiming that it's saving democracy from communism. But it's very soft on fascism, both World War II variety or the kind now. Yes, 1-2. I'll take both of us.
There's a brother here from Mexico City who would like to pose a question to you in Spanish. But I'll translate.
Did he understand my lecture in English? Okay. There's a gentleman from Mexico City who's going to speak in, for those people back in the cheap seats, he's going to speak in Spanish and it's going to be translated.
Entiendo que hablando de imperialismo en Estados Unidos y en muchos países capitalistas.
I understand that speaking of imperialism in the United States and in many capitalist countries,
es hablar de grupos dominantes.
Speaking of dominant groups.
Could you not translate every single phrase? Let him say a couple sentences and then you translate it, okay?
Formados por la gente que está en el gobierno y por la gente que está en las principales esferas económicas controlando la economía.
Groups composed of people within the government and groups composed of people within the higher spheres controlling the economy.
Esto también está reunido y trabajan en conjunto con las grandes productoras de televisión, de cine y en general de los medios masivos.
That comes together with the people that work at the highest levels of the media, in television, in theater, and the other communication means.
En México, el año pasado, sufrió una terrible baja la credibilidad del gobierno.
The government in Mexico last year suffered a decrease in credibility.
A pesar del uso de los medios masivos, la pregunta es, en Estados Unidos, ¿cómo se ha deteriorado, si es que lo han hecho, la imagen, la credibilidad del gobierno de Estados Unidos ante la opinión pública de la gente del Estados Unidos?
The Mexican government lost a lot of credibility last year in spite of its attempts to use the media to shore up its credibility. So my question is, how is the credibility of the government of the United States perceived by the people here? The way that it's expressed, the way that the media shows the United States government to be, how do people perceive the credibility of the United States government?
Well, Gramsci once pointed out that people have two levels of consciousness, the great Italian communist Antonio Gramsci. There's that level of consciousness that comes from the communication universe, which is controlled by the media. And so people very often are taken in or they don't have the means to question. Let's take El Salvador right now. There are many people in America who don't particularly want to see their tax dollars going to El Salvador, killing these people. They don't even know which side is which. But they're told that it's in the U.S. national interest, these are communists, they're told communists are bad, they might threaten us or something. That's becoming harder and harder now, you know, to keep saying communists are bad, especially when communists are voluntarily surrendering power in a way in which fascists don't do. But so they go sort of go along with it, or some are firmly convinced of it. Gramsci also said there's another level of consciousness that people has, which has to do with their direct immediate experience, which is, and that raises all sorts of questions, that does cause them to sometimes question the credibility of the larger institutions that act upon them and even challenge those institutions. That's things like, why is this war still going on? Why must we be there? You know, since they don't get legitimate answers. See, the ruling elites can't give them the real answers. They can't say you're there to die for global capitalism, for capital accumulation process, because we don't want a competing social order, because if they have one there, who knows where it'll end and what'll happen to us and everything we have that belongs to us. They can't say that, so they say we're there for strategic reasons or that little country might conquer us, and these reasons don't sound very convincing. And so people then begin to question, why do I have to pay so much taxes? Why must my son register for the draft? Why is there these dioxin dumps here? Why are these birth defects from the dioxin dumps? So there's a lot in their immediate experience which begins to tell them that something's wrong. And even those things, to the extent that the media can maintain or has to maintain its credibility, it must take some account of those things sometimes. So it's finally got to report some things about Rocky Flats, that you're getting poisoned from Rocky Flats. I mean, it comes out finally. To the extent that the media does, to maintain its credibility, deal with those levels of reality at times, that's when the right wing comes in and says, oh, you see, it's a liberal conspiracy that's out to make corporate America and everybody look bad. So there's no guarantee that everything the military does or the government does will gain credibility. What is surprising in our society is the extent to which people still question and are skeptical. I mean, when you think of the 8 years of pulverizing that you got, the last 2 years of Carter's administration and the first six of the Reagan administration, even the seventh, the pulverizing propaganda output about the Cold War, about the Red Menace, about Moscow's intentions, about this and that. And then finally he's having to sign a treaty and look at the polls, which say overwhelmingly, yeah, let's be friends with the Russians. Yeah, let's sign more treaties. Yeah, let's cut more. And so you get Defense Secretary Cheney now saying we're going to cut our military budget. I mean, he's also getting a push from the deficit and from the whole financial structure, cleverly trying to spend the Soviets into poverty. We're spending ourselves into poverty. But it's rather extraordinary that despite that kind of output, you can find a tremendous resistance in America. It's not an anti-imperialist majority. I disagree with Gus Hall if you could call it anti-imperialist, because most Americans don't know what the hell imperialism is. But it is anti-interventionist. There's a very strong majority. That's the Vietnam syndrome. So their propaganda works and controls what we think about, but it doesn't always control what we think. It controls what we have to, what we usually discuss or debate, but it doesn't really have absolute control over us, and we should take heart from that. The limits of propaganda are the limits of reality. They keep saying they've got a wonderful policy in Central America, it's working and all that. But then year after year after year, the fighting and the killing continues, and people start saying, what the hell is this policy all about? You see, that's starting to come up now. I would like to answer more questions, but Harry, let me make you the last question.
We've been bombarded by the media with this theme, and that is communism, because of the recent events, is dying or dead, or Marxism. That's the theme.
I have to repeat the question for the damn nuisance media. We've been bombarded by good media. This is a good media. We've been bombarded by the theme that communism is dead or going. I thought I did comment on that. I'm invited to comment on it. I thought I did in the context of my talk that. What most of these people mean when they say they don't want socialism anymore is they don't want the one-party rule, the privileges, the corruption, the stagnation, the poor labor discipline, the lack of innovation, whatever else. It doesn't mean that they don't want the historic victories of the social wage and all that sort of thing. So I don't think communism is dead. I think what you'll see is a democratic development and a new level of struggle. You're going to see a lot of struggle in these countries. See, some of them think they're going to become Finland or Sweden, and they may end up being more like Mexico or Turkey. They think their economies now they're going to move toward that with the political. Just a few years ago, you had Polish solidarity unions having strikes against the communist government. Within this year, I predict, in fact, it's already happening, you will have communist-led unions in Poland having strikes against the Solidarity government. And the communists, it's one of the few things that Polish communists can do well, which is organize unions and strikes. I think most of these reforms are really designed for capitalist restoration. I don't think the leaders of these countries, the protest leaders, I don't think they're really just out there for democracy. They really are out there for capitalism. George Bush has made that clear. His commitment is to capitalism. He has given no money to Poland. He has offered no money to Poland, and he has legislated and appropriated no money to Poland. Absolutely no money. What is finally being appropriated is $425 million to something called the Enterprise Fund. And that Enterprise Fund will be used explicitly, very explicit, Bush said, for the purpose of facilitating the transition from public ownership to private ownership, the privatization and the nationalization of ownership. It's money which we, American taxpayers, are in effect subsidizing the Fortune 500 capital penetration of Poland. That's what that's all about. His interest is not in democracy, his interest is in capitalism. If forced to choose between a democracy without capitalism, as in Chile, or the beginnings in Guatemala, or wherever, or a capitalism without democracy, he will choose the latter. You can take the case of China, where the Chinese suppressed a popular movement for whatever, a very confused popular movement, but nevertheless, who was one of the people that defended the killings in Tiananmen Square? It was overlooked But George Bush was one of the people who defended and said, let's not get too carried away, the Chinese leaders are responsible, because they had $25 billion capital investment in China. And if it's a question of choosing having a country of capitalism without the democracy, that's okay with them. If China turns into a fascist dictatorship but allows fuller capital penetration, they will be more popular than one of the Eastern European countries which has democracy but hangs on to some form of democratic socialism. That will be less popular. That gentleman there who has a radio up to his ear. Yeah, you're the last answer, you're the last question.
Yes. Can you give us an interpretation of the Reagan-Bush administration, their stand on South Africa? Because it seems like it's perpetuates that Reagan is just out with the old, in with the old. Could you tell me how you feel about that?
Well, just what you said, the Reagan-Bush administration position on South Africa is, now, don't push them too hard, you might alienate them and let them have their natural development, a position which they would not accord Nicaragua, because they can live much better with racism and oppression and fascism as long as there's a big capital investment there, then they can live with a democratic Nicaragua which allows opposition parties and elections, but which has been moving in a more collectivist position. So that's it. My voice is going, so thank you very much.